It's June 14th, 2016. Welcome to Raging Chicken Radio's Out to Coop podcast. Each week, we check in with our Capitol correspondent, Sean Kitchen, on the good, the bad, and the ugly that is Harrisburg, PA. Raging Chicken Radio is a project of Raging Chicken Press. Check out all our citizen journalism at RagingChickenPress.org. You can subscribe to Raging Chicken Radio on Podbean, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and iTunes. And subscribing to Raging Chicken Radio is one of the easiest things that you can do to help support this podcast and all the work that we do with Raging Chicken. And if you want to help build a progressive activist media network for PA and beyond, you can become a member for as little as $2 a month. $2 a month. I mean, we're talking less than a cost of beer, a bad beer, mind you, or a cup of coffee. Less than a beer or a cup of coffee per month can help us out tremendously. Raging Chicken is turning 5 in July, and our 2016 membership drive is all about preparing for the next 5 years of Pull No Punches, progressive media in PA and beyond. You can be part of helping sustain homegrown citizen journalism. Just go to RagingChickenPress.org and click Become a Member under the Support and Membership tab. Or if you are listening on Podbean, just click, quote, Become a Patron button and you'll be on your way. Be sure to check out all the thank you gifts for each membership level while you're there. Today, we want to say a special thank you to our newest member, Ben Tupper, who joined at the organizer level. That's $15 a month, folks. And that means that Ben is eligible to receive a Raging Chicken Oval sticker, a union-made Raging Chicken pin, access to our upcoming live Raging Chicken Google Hangouts, and his choice of book among our feature reads, which includes titles such as Naomi Klein's This Changes Everything, Lee Fang's The Machine, and Nancy Eisenberg's White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America. I also want to take this opportunity to plug Ben's book as a thank you right back at you, man. His book is called Greetings from Afghanistan, Send More Ammo, Dispatches from Taliban Country. And as a special thanks to Ben for joining at the $15 a month level, we want to extend a special offer to you. Any new member who joins at least the $5 a month level, we will send you a copy of Ben's book, Greetings from Afghanistan, Send More Ammo as a thank you gift. And, you know, it's an amazing read and it's definitely worth checking out. So all you got to do before the end of the month, you got a couple weeks left, join at the $5 a month level or more. I'd love to have you come in at the $10 a month level. That'd be phenomenal. But at least the $5 a month level, and I will personally send you a copy of Ben's book, Greetings from Afghanistan, Send More Ammo. In addition to today's episode of Out to Coop, we will release the latest episode of our interview series, The Sit Down. This week, I talk with Marlena Eck, the editor and founder of the Lehigh Valley Vanguard and co-founder of Rag Queen Periodical. Marlena joins us to talk about millennial radicalism, citizen media, and working class activism. Be sure to check that out. Now, this week, Sean is still on vacation, folks, in the great Mountain West. I know. We promised to get you an update from Sean from the road. But, you know, the only peep I've gotten from him has come through his Facebook and Instagram feed. So I guess that means he's having a good time. Hopefully we'll have him back next week to talk about all the craziness in Harrisburg and across the region. Today, of course, is the last primary of this year's presidential election. It will take place in D.C., and I'm sure that we're going to see lots of movement in the Democratic Party after tonight's results come in. And we're going to talk a lot about that, at least a little bit about that. We'll see how much stuff happens next week by way of recapping the road to the Democratic and Republican conventions later in July. All eyes really are going to be on the next move of a political movement that coalesced around Bernie Sanders. And of course, what will be the next great circus act in the show that is Donald Trump. So we'll get to all that on next week's Out to Coop. And hopefully we're going to have Sean Kitchen back in the seat. Today, we're going to do things a little bit differently. We're going to go a little bit different format than we normally do. Originally, I was thinking about having it on another guest host. If you recall that last week, we had on Glenn Richardson. Glenn Richardson's a political science department at Kutztown University. We was talking a little bit about the Bernie Sanders movement and a bunch of the stuff about the elections. But I was going to bring on another guest host today for Out to Coop. But I decided to go with a little bit of different format. I'll tell you a little bit of why. Last night, that's Monday the 13th, for those of you who are listening to this after the fact, I was on the Rick Smith show talking about the Abscuff contract fight with a PA state system of higher education. Now, Abscuff is, of course, the 5,500 member union that represents faculty and coaches in the PASHE system, Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education, which is interesting, right? This has been called PASHE for the longest time. And there was this weird moment this past year where Frank Brogan is the chancellor of the state system. Frank Brogan and his people up there basically informed Abscuff, the union and faculty members, that they are no longer going to be referring to themselves as PASHE. They are now going to refer to themselves simply as the state system. Now, think about it what you will. Like, I just think it's number one, it's just kind of weird to go with something completely generic. It doesn't even have Pennsylvania, the name, just the state system. It's kind of just strange. But also, you know, take this for what you will. But why would you choose a name where the acronym for your name is SS? I mean, think about it. We are the SS. I mean, come on. There's someone who's sitting up there in the PASHE a PR office who should just lose their job over this one. I mean, why would you want to name yourself after kind of like, you know, Nazi special forces, right? I mean, it's just strange. No, and I'm not saying that was their intent. I'm just saying, like, you know, this is like potential PR disaster, right? But whatever. That's completely beside the point. But this past Friday, and the reason we're going to this kind of format today, this past Friday, June 10th, PASHE basically dropped a 146-page proposal on the negotiations table after claiming for months that it did not have any former proposals. And if you're watching on YouTube, I'm going to hold it up for you. All right, so here it is. This is the 146-page proposal that I've just finished combing through. And it basically amounted to a direct full frontal attack on public higher education in Pennsylvania. For those of you who've been paying attention to public education in the state, you'll know that the especially higher ed public education, you'll recall that in the last round of contract negotiations, Abscuff went almost 2 years without a contract, and the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education, PASHE, basically put forward a proposal that would just radically alter the state system in such ways that it would make send the bulk of the faculty members to the poorhouse, would eliminate programs. I mean, a whole bunch of stuff that would have been disastrous. And Abscuff came very close to its first ever strike until suddenly PASHE decided, no, we can't do this. Well, this is basically take two on the same concepts that they introduced during the last round of negotiations. And today I want to get into the weeds a bit about their proposal. PASHE did something interesting. So for those of you who've kind of pay attention to labor issues and kind of contract negotiations and so on, you'll know that one of the key ALEC bills, you know, the American Legislative Exchange Council, one of these key right-wing bills that they're trying to push forward as an attack on working people, especially organized labor at the state level, is this bill that they're calling for open negotiations. You know, and like most of these bills, they sound okay on first blush, right? It's only when you actually start thinking about, well, okay, what are the implications of this? Now, anybody who's been through contract negotiations, whether you're talking about something on a smaller scale or you're talking about a contract negotiations of, you know, here we are with the 5,500 faculty and coaches, you know that negotiations are closed for a reason. Right. Negotiations are private for a reason. And the idea there is that you want people at the table on both sides, on the union side and on the state side, in our case, or on the management side, to be able to say things. Right. You want to leave room for people to get pissed off. You want to leave room for people to float ideas that are half baked. Right. You know, that are just kind of ideas of trying to work through. That's, you know, the best case scenario is a negotiations process where you're actually seriously trying to work out differences in a positive way. Now, you don't kind of like announce to the world everything that goes on at those tables unless you really want to, you know, gut the negotiations process, right? Unless you want to hurt the other side or something like that, which is why the kind of confidentiality of that process usually has been, you know, abided by. So these new bills, what they are calling for is that if there's a state government that is negotiating with state institutions, right, like this one, the 14 state-owned universities of Pennsylvania, that all the proposals should be made public, right? You should put everything on the line. And it takes away some of the ability to actually work together, actually to do the real negotiation process at the table. So on the one hand, right, it dissuades people from actually putting out proposals that you can work on, because the minute you put out a proposal, it's going to get published on some website somewhere, right? And then you got, you know, it can be used for political purposes, basically, right? We kind of want to keep politics out of this stuff. You really want to focus on what, the contract at hand. Anyways, so this has been floated a few times in Pennsylvania. It's kind of got defeated. But Frank Brogan and the people in the Board of Governor's office basically have decided on their own that they were going to basically take that policy, that right-wing ALEC endorsed policy, and make it their own. So now everything about our negotiation, all formal proposals are published. And, you know, frankly, from the union side of things, it hasn't worked out all that bad. I mean, you know, the proposals have been fairly reasonable and fairly kind of limited in scope. But on the state system side, right, the PASHI side of things, they just put out their proposal. And now we get to see the full 146-page proposal. And I got to say, anyone who's really thinking about the implications of what they're after here, I don't see how they come to any other conclusion that they're really trying to kind of go the way of, say, gutting the state system, privatizing big sections of the state system, and kind of turning faculty work into kind of like, you know, the work of automatons. And, you know, again, you want to say I'm exaggerating about it, that's fine. So what this means is that the PASHI proposal really has got the makings of all the best, like, right-wing tactics that we're now familiar with, right? You know, divide and conquer, destroy job security, shift power to highly paid administrators, and turn education into a mindless process of producing cogs for a corporate machine, right? I mean, that's what we see across the country right now, and state by state. And here you have it, a kind of blatant attempt to do that. So we're going to take a quick break now, and we come back to that. We're going to get into the weeds a little bit of this contract fight, so that you might, you know, see a little bit about how this stuff works. And you know, the stakes are high here. Ken Mash, who's the president of ABSCUF, has made it pretty clear publicly that unless PASHI is going to do some serious negotiations and back away from this radical proposal that they're putting on the table to gut the state system of higher education, then faculty are going to have to be prepared to stand up and fight. And what that means in the contract of negotiations, right, the contract of union contracts, right, is that ABSCUF is inching ever more closely to its first ever strike. So the stakes are pretty high here. So when we come back, I'm going to get into some of the weeds, like I said, of this proposal that's coming from the state system of higher education. I'll walk you through it a little bit, and then we'll take a little bit of a look at what ABSCUF was proposing, just so you can see by contrast of what it actually means to kind of negotiate reasonably and what it means to kind of, you know, basically shoot the moon for, I don't know, the destruction of public higher education, I guess. So anyways, this is Kevin Mahoney. I am the editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. And when we come back, we'll get into the weeds of this provocative contract proposal for the state system of higher education. This is Raging Chicken Radio's Out to Coop podcast. We'll be back right after this.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1921. During that summer, the battle waged over the efforts to unionize the southwestern West Virginia coal mines. The miners had been evicted from their company homes and had established tent colonies. One was located at Lick Creek. On this fateful day, state police and company gun thugs raided the Lick Creek camp. The police claimed that members of the tent colony had been shooting at strikebreakers. They arrested 56 men and destroyed the tents and furniture in the camp. One striker was shot down and killed. Later that summer, at their convention in Matewan, West Virginia, the delegates of the United Mine Workers of America adopted a resolution condemning the action. The attack on the tent colony was included in a list of grievances against the mine owners. It described the attack as one of the most brutal murders ever committed in the history of our state by the state police and deputies. Composed of the Baldwin Felts detectives was the attack on the Lick Creek Tent Colony on June 14, 1921, in which our brother, Alex Breadlove, willfully murdered by the state police while his hands were uplifted and begging for God to have mercy on his soul. The resolution went on to condemn the atrocities against the miners and demand the federal government and governor of West Virginia to restore law to the local police forces. The resolution was sent to the President of the United States, West Virginia's Governor Morgan, and the officials of the American Federation of Labor. It was also sent to Labor and other newspapers. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio's Out to Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney. I'm the editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. And today I'm going solo here on Out to Coop. I mean, normally Sean Kitchen is joining us from Harrisburg, PA to talk about all the kind of insider stuff in our state capital. But today I'm flying solo. Sean is out there in the Great Mountain West on vacation, hopefully enjoying himself. Today we're going to talk a little bit about the ABSCUF contract fight. ABSCUF is, of course, the faculty union for nearly 5,500 faculty and coaches in the 14 state-owned universities in Pennsylvania. And this past Friday, June 10th, the State System of Higher Education, PASHE, put a proposal on the table that was, you know, could potentially really gut public higher education. So to give you a sense of the union's response to this, I want to kind of read from ABSCUF's press release that was released Friday afternoon, and I'll kind of read some chunks of it. So this is, quote, "Negotiators for the Association of Pennsylvania State College and University Faculties are outraged after today's bargaining session with the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education held at ABSCUF's Harrisburg office." Quote, "The hallmark of our universities has always been that students will learn from highly credentialed faculty members who are dedicated to their students and their universities," said Dr. Jamie Martin, ABSCUF vice president and chair of the faculty negotiations team. Quote, "Our alumni consistently point fondly at that aspect of their university experience. The state system now openly seeks to undermine that quality," unquote. ABSCUF president Dr. Ken Mash echoed Martin's reaction to the proposal, and he said, quote, "Every student, every parent, and every alumnus of our university should be insulted by the proposals the state system put on the table today," Mash said. "In fact, every resident of the Commonwealth ought to be alarmed. The faculty will not sit idly by while the leadership of the state system tries to move our great universities in the direction of Trump University." Boom. Now, ABSCUF's leadership and negotiations team are all pretty pissed off. If you recall, we reported on this at Raging Chicken back in April. There was a legislative assembly meeting, and there's a meeting of all the delegates from the faculty union where basically following some budget hearings where you had state legislators who were just nasty. I mean, the way they talked about faculty, the way they talked about the work of the state system of higher education, it was like just spewing a bunch of right wing kind of nut job nonsense on the floor of the state legislature. And you've got Frank Brogan, the chancellor of the state system of higher education, and everyone involved in the management level just sitting idly by and letting it happen. It was really remarkable. Well, that accompanied with the fact that the state system had just basically been stonewalling ABSCUF in terms of negotiations and refusing to meet and everything like this, it was made people pissed off. And it came very close at that point. Faculty did. The faculty representatives for the union came very close to voting for a strike authorization right then and there. But they decided, wait a minute. Let's see. We've got two dates coming up in June for negotiations, so we're going to put that off a little bit. Well, that first date came, And with it came the bombshell. So I, what I want to do is I want to give you a little sketch of what the state system is proposing. Okay. And I'm going to kind of break these into some categories. And frankly, it's a 146-page proposal. And I've gone through this and still I've not read everything closely. I've tried to kind of like, I've tried to focus on the worst of it, right? There's still lots more in here that I would love to go into even further, but that would be so far into the weeds for the time that we have here that today is really, I just couldn't do it. We'll have to get into it another time or you could read about it, Raging Chicken. So first of all, let's kind of walk through this one. Now, ABSCUF, the ABSCUF current contract, right, is basically pretty much known to be, the gold standard when it comes to adjunct faculty or contingent faculty, right? There were days I used to work at the, I interned at the American Federation of Teachers in Washington, D.C. back in, I think it was 1999 or 2000. And my job as that intern was basically to update a report that they had made. The report was called The Vanishing Professor. And it was a look at this kind of trend toward turning all of faculty members into part-time adjuncts. And, you know, again, we've talked a lot about that on this program and we write a lot about that. But basically what that means is that you have an adjunct is basically, you know, that faculty member who's getting paid per class and they're getting paid per class with no job security, no benefits. And they're teaching they're carrying the bulk of the teaching load at many, many universities. The pay for that, when I was an adjunct, when I at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., I was getting paid about, at first, $1,500 per class. And then when we started to organize a union, they bumped that up. For the first time in, I think it was like 15 years, they bumped it up to $2,000 a class. Today, the range is from, you know, $1,800 on the low end to maybe $4,400, $4,500 on the upper end. Depends if they have a union or not. But it's basically, it's academic piecework. And if you talk to any academic, any teacher who works as an adjunct in higher education, you know that they're piecing together a living often at multiple universities, taking on multiple jobs. And it is not a situation that supports the highest quality of education. And don't get me wrong, these faculty members, they bust their butt. I mean, I work with a bunch of right in my department and they're some of the best faculty that we have. But that's all that underscores the point is like, don't you want to keep the best faculty member and not just kind of treat them like disposable academic labor? So as I was doing that report, I came across the ABSCUF contract as I was, you know, calling them around the country and talking to faculty members who were organizing unions at a variety of different universities, private universities, public universities, and asking them about what provisions that they're having in their contracts for adjunct faculty members. Now, virtually to the letter, any time that somebody directed me to a good example of a contract that represented the gold standard for adjunct faculty, they kept on saying ABSCUF. Now, back then, I had no idea what ABSCUF was. And I'm sure there's people listening now, ABSCUF, they're, you know, still trying to get their head around the acronym, right? But I didn't know what it was, right? I wasn't from Pennsylvania, so I wasn't familiar with that. But they kept on pointing to ABSCUF, right? ABSCUF contract. Now, why, right? Well, for about three reasons. Number one is that adjunct faculty in the contract parlance is temporary faculty. We're going to talk about it as adjunct faculty. Adjunct faculty were basically paid for the most part on scale with entering tenure track faculty. Now, what that means is that if I say, for example, if I have a PhD and I get hired as on the tenure track, right? In the contract, there's your scale, right? There's what your starting salary is, right? That matched up exactly if I was a non-tenure track faculty member, an adjunct faculty member was hired with a PhD there, I would start at that same exact cost or same exact salary, right? So that's kind of on par, right? This is kind of what we call about equity. Now, as you move on, right, the equity is not as pronounced, right? Because tenure track faculty actually move up steps as they accrue years of service. Non-tenure track faculty or adjunct faculty do not, right? So last thing I'm going to say, it's a perfect system. Matter of fact, our union has consistently argued for steps for adjunct faculty, be that as it may. So that's the first thing, the equity issue. The second thing has to do with a path to conversion. Because the vast majority of adjunct faculty who teach at PASHA universities are full-time. That means they don't teach just one or two classes. Most are full-time, and they're taking up a chunk of our load, right? They're teaching the same course load that a tenure track faculty teaches. They're advising students in many cases, if not most cases. They're participating in the life of the department. They're doing research. They're doing all these kind of things that tenure track faculty members would do. So there's provisions in our contract, there's Article 11, 11G and H, which provides paths for conversion. Right. The idea is that if in your fourth year, if you've been working at the university, right, say my university is Kutztown University, but if you have a faculty member who's been working at Kutztown University for 4 years, right, they're eligible for conversion. If the department that that faculty member works for kind of votes to convert that person to a tenure track line, well, they get converted, right? They could get converted under the tenure track. Now, they still have to then go through that, you know, 4 or 5 years process to get to tenure, right? So you've kind of lengthened the process to tenure from like 4 to 5 years, right, to, you know, 8 years, if not more in some cases. But there's that path to conversion and path to kind of stability, right? The whole idea behind wanting to kind of have that stable faculty has everything to do with what we believe is the way you deliver quality education to students. Is that very often students come to the state system schools, not simply because it's a good value, right? It's not simply a cost analysis, right? It's because they know that they're going to get more one-on-one interaction with their faculty members, right? They don't want to get lost in the crowd. I can't tell you how many times I hear that from students, is that they chose Kutztown over, say, Penn State or Temple or even some, you know, Gettysburg College came up last year, but they choose it over some of these other places because they said they don't want to get lost in the shuffle. And they hear from, you know, friends of theirs, family members from theirs who came to these schools, that they always have access to their faculty members. And it's true, even in our contract, right? We're required to have 5 office hours a week, right? Minimum, right? 5 office hours a week distributed over 3 days, right? Which means that you're trying to provide access to students, to faculty members. And generally, you know, we got lots of students who come and use that time, right? Which is exactly what you want. That kind of interaction, for my money, is especially important when you're talking about serving a lot of first-generation college students, students who generally come from kind of more precarious home lives, economic class, working class backgrounds, right? Who don't have that kind of, you know, that cultural capital of their kind of, you know, fellow wealthy Pennsylvanians or kind of regional folks. The idea that you need that interaction in order to succeed in higher ed. That's what the state system of higher education was built for, like quality education at affordable costs that would serve the kind of, you know, working families of Pennsylvania. And that's the mission, right? That's in, you know, the founding documents of the state system. So that's why you want to kind of ensure that you have faculty that are there, right? And there's practical matters too as well. You have student who comes in, you know, and you have their first year class, they said they want to transfer, they want to apply to an internship. You want to make sure that faculty member is going to be there for that student to go to, to get that recommendation, right? To get some advice. And how do you go about through this process? If you're kind of churning over massive amounts of faculty members through an adjunct pool, they do at so many other universities, from semester to semester, that student cannot guarantee that they're going to be able to get that, talk to that professor again. And when I worked as a, you know, for years as an adjunct, that was true. I mean, it was kind of sometimes I'd be there for a semester, sometimes not. I'd shift schools, and it was always hard for for students to track me down if, especially if, you know, your email gets shut off because your tech contract is technically not renewed yet, a whole bunch of issues like that. So ABSCUF has basically been the gold standard because we've said we want to put a priority on, you know, a stable faculty, right, to deliver quality education. The problem is that the rest of the academic world, what we see is happening nationwide, is they've had this shift that now at many, if not most universities, 65, 70, upwards of 75% of the faculty at colleges and universities across the country are adjunct faculty or contingent faculty that are either there as adjunct teaching faculty or they're graduate teaching students or graduate teaching assistants, right, who are enrolled as students, but who are teaching a bulk of the, you know, gen ed classes along with their adjunct colleagues. So 65, 75, even, you know, I'm sure there's places that probably hit close to the 80% margin, are this adjunct contingent faculty. And there's only one reason why you do that, right? It's that you're looking at higher education as a business and you're looking to drive down the cost, right? Take away the power of faculty members to determine the quality education and have control over their classrooms and basically have, you know, highly paid administrators making all the decisions and faculty are just deprofessionalized and turned to cogs in a machine. So AppScuff has that gold standard, right? Most other places are trying to get to where we have been. Well, the state system has a different idea about that. From the state system's perspective, they believe that we should basically go the other direction. We should become like everybody else. And we see this in our culture all the time now. It's like, it's really freaking crazy, right? Is that you say, you see somebody who's got, you know, the right way to do things, right? And then you have these, you know, administrators and kind of right-wing nut jobs that come along and say, oh, well, because everybody doesn't have it, we want to take it away from you and bring you down to suffer with the rest of us, as opposed to saying, wait a minute, how do we make sure that more people have what you have the protections of a union contract, have the protections of job security, have a path for conversion, right? All this kind of stuff, right? Well, instead, here's what Pashi wants to do. It wants to take, right now we have a four course load. That means four classes per semester, which is a heavy load for everyone. That is true for regular faculty, tenure track faculty like me. That is also true for non-tenure track faculty or adjunct faculty who are full-time. They want to, number one, they want to take away that possibility of conversion. Just eliminate it. If you look at the text, right, it's just all struck out. They want to eliminate that possibility entirely so that there is no hope for conversion to tenure track faculty, that they will always be adjuncts if they are going to be working here. They will always be precarious, right? They will always be at will, if you will. That's number one. Number two, they want to allow graduate students to start teaching, right? Graduate student doesn't even need to have a degree. They don't need to have a master's degree or a PhD degree to teach the classes, right? They can just simply walk in and teach. If they've, as long as they've taken what? I think it's 18 credit hours of graduate courses. Yeah, sure. Send them into the classroom, right? Let them go about do this. Now, you think what you want, right? I was a graduate student. I had to do this. I can tell you firsthand that when I first started teaching, I had no idea. I did not know what the hell I was doing when I went to the classroom. I thought I did, but I did not. Right? That took years to acquire. Now, it's up to you. Do you think that's the situation you want students to be in, right? Students are now, their faculty members are going to be people who may have absolutely no experience teaching, right? No background in doing that, and are just starting a graduate program. I mean, we've made the choice, right, as a union, as a faculty, not to go down that road. They want to ensure that we have actually faculty members who are teaching the vast majority of the classes. So they want to do that. They want to increase the percentage of adjuncts at our campus. Right now, we have a cap at 25%. They want to increase that to 30%. Not only that, that doesn't even include kind of replacements. So say, for example, you got a faculty goes on medical leave for a year, right? And you hire an adjunct faculty to cover that for the year. That's not included in that percentage. So the actual percentage that they're shooting for is higher than 30%. Those are some of the big things there. Now, they also want to take those adjunct faculty who they've stripped away the possibility of conversion, right? And they want to increase their workload. They want to say, instead of teaching four classes per semester, now you teach five. Right, you teach five classes per semester, same salary, but five classes. So we're talking about a 20% reduction in salary for those five classes instead of four. Now, in the state system language, Ken Marshall, right, who's the spokesperson for Pashi, Ken Marshall, I mean, he's been drinking from his Orwellian Kool-Aid lately, because I tell you, it's been pretty remarkable how they're phrasing their proposal. So what they call, or what I just read to you is kind of, you know, the increased workload. What they say is that that will allow adjuncts more time to focus on their teaching because we're not going to evaluate them on anything but their teaching. And now they can really be focused on teaching. It's incredible. They call this modernization of labor and higher education, modernization of the workforce, right? In other words, making it more precarious, right? Decreasing salaries and exploiting adjunct faculty members. It's remarkable. So not only that, let's go down to the part-time level. So if you're teaching courses part-time, you're an adjunct who's teaching part-time, right now there's this formula that says you get paid basically 1/24 per class, the regular faculty load to work at part-time level. They want to decrease that to 1/30. So if you're going to be working at a, you know, on a part-time basis, on a per-class basis, you're going to be kind of floating below the poverty line, right? You're going to be kind of even more precarious, right? So all the incentives here, right, that Pashi is arguing for, all the incentives are about increasing workload for adjunct faculty members, decreasing the amount of salary and benefits that they receive, and basically incentivizing the hiring of adjunct faculty at the expense of tenure track faculty members, right? That's the direction we're moving in. It's pretty, pretty incredible. So by contrast, right, if you look at what the union was proposing, right, you know, and again, ABSCUF got blindsided by this. They had no idea that the state system was going to put on this kind of draconian proposal on the table last week. The faculty, by the contrast, right, ABSCUF was proposing the basically increasing the security of those very same faculty members. So under Article 11, which again, once again, is about this adjunct faculty members, they basically want improve Article 11 conversion procedures, right? So state system wants to rip them away. ABSCUF, the faculty union, wants to basically make them better by doing things like require that the university provide information regarding eligible candidates for conversion, right? Seems reasonable. Shorten the conversion timeframes. Now, you know you're going to get pushback from the administration on that one, right? But if you can convert people in 3 years instead of four or five, right, then you're actually going to, you know, solidify that that faculty and make it more secure. You want to say, okay, look, there was a problem in that conversion things. There were some people, right, a small minority of faculty members who really only wanted to teach. And the concern was if they don't get voted for conversion, then they're going to have to leave the university. But ABSCUF is saying, okay, we hear that. So basically we want to say, okay, look, we're going to still require a department vote, right? The department are going to devote whether to convert this faculty member or not. But if the department says, no, we're not going to convert them, that person can still stay and teach. If that's what they want and that's what the department thinks is best, okay, they can stay on. Now, think about what that means, is that the decision is there, right, about who's making the determination about quality teaching and everything are the faculty members, right? The very people that are trained to do this stuff, not some bureaucrat, highly paid bureaucrat that's kind of looking to kind of build their resume on their way to kind of the presidency of who knows what university across the country, probably some freaking Trump university at this point. But then it also basically says, look, we want to also kind of make it clear how a person cannot be converted. And these are, you know, our suggestions, three suggestions about why a president can say, no, we're not going to convert that person. So, for example, if courses have been eliminated, that makes sense, right? Here's this person who's teaching these courses and the courses have gone away. Their course load is gone. Okay, you can understand that, right? Things like, you know, the courses have been taught by a temporary faculty member who's been converted to tenure track status already, right? So trying to kind of clear it up, trying to make it more rational and transparent of a process. They also want to, you know, look at ways to ensure that there's not going to be discrimination in that conversion or hiring process, right? These are kind of standard things. It's not saying that we're just going to kind of radically, you know, make everybody, like, as soon as they're hired, immediately tenure track. They recognize that need for some sort of flexibility. They recognize these ups and downs, but say we all go towards, keep on moving towards that stable faculty body. It's just a huge, huge contrast. So you've got the state system, again, just that, you know, incredible. It's just increase the teaching load, remove the ability for a adjunct faculty member to be converted, right? Decrease their pay, increase their precarity, right? And for what? For what? Now, the state system is going to cry poverty, right? But we're not going to have enough time to get into this on today's podcast, but we're just going to have to get into some of the financial shenanigans that have been going on at Pashi universities now for the past decade. Because, you know, I'm telling you, if Pashi wants to play this kind of game, then, you know, they're going to have to basically come to terms with their kind of Enron-style accounting schemes that they've been relying upon for the past decade. But we'll get into that. And if you, again, search that up, you go to look at Wall Street on the Susquehanna. You search that at Raging Chicken Press website, you'll come up with my article that's kind of been – that unpacked that a few years back. So here's that first part. We're going to kind of make adjunct faculty's life worse, right? Step number one. All right, the second group of things has everything to do with a power grab. In union universities, right, we talk about shared governance, right? And that's basically meaning that, okay, if you're going to be decisions over curriculum, there's going to be decisions over the kind of the academic life of a university, right, that administrators can't simply impose this stuff on faculty members. That faculty members, the experts in the field, the people who do the teaching, the people that we hire to educate folks, need to have a say in that. So there has to be negotiations of that process. That's a shared governance process. They want to chip away at that shared governance process and basically shift the power once again to management. I'll give you some examples. And some of them might seem petty or small, but these are important. You take away the faculty's role in transfer decisions. So you basically, for those people who are familiar with the Verizon strike that just took place, right? One of the biggest complaints among Verizon workers was that their managers, right, would basically say, okay, hey, look, you have to go to this place, whatever, 150 miles away and work there for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, you know, we'll tell you how long you're going to be there. And the managers say, we have the right to do that. We have the right to kind of pull you away from your home, send you off there. Doesn't matter if you have a family, doesn't matter if you have kids, doesn't matter if you have responsibilities, forget it. We're just going to pull you off that site and throw you to another one. Well, here we are. State system of higher education is essentially saying the same thing. It wants to remove the faculty role in kind of making those kind of decisions, right? So it might make sense for a faculty member to move from one department to another, but you actually want that to be a process where that's going to make academic sense, intellectual sense. It's going to fit with the curriculum, right? That kind of thing. And you need to review that stuff. Here's what, no, administrators can do that. So I can take you, right, as a faculty member and say, pluck you out. Oh, I know that you were hired in this department. We're going to put you over out of the department. Matter of fact, we're going to take you out of your university and put you at a branch campus. Or you know what? Maybe we're going to transfer you to another university for a little bit because they have a need over there. And you know what? We're going to force you to work summer because we're going to transfer you over there. I mean, that's the path that they're laying out here, right? To transfer all this at the will of the president of the university, or one. Then the one that actually, even in the union's press release, this did not make the press release, but this is the one that just kind of had the hair on the back of my neck stand up, I'll tell you. And you know, it was like that kind of like fear, anger, like response, is that they basically want to make assessment part of teaching evaluations of faculty. Now, why is this important? Okay. For the past several years that, you know, faculty or PASHI administrators have basically had this like, you know, obsession with assessment. They want to ensure that every single course that is on the books has these student learning outcomes. Okay. Makes sense, right? So you do that sort of outcomes. And we've had to go like jump through all these hoops to do all these formalized quantitative and qualitative assessments of all of our courses. Now, in theory, faculty generally are not opposed to that idea. But what they did is say, we're going to have this huge push and we're going to put it, and it's all going to be on top of your regular workload. There's going to be no course releases to do that work. You're going to have to develop it all on your own time, and we need it now. Now, Kutztown University, we've watched our assessments, right, and we've put a lot of time in my department, and I've been on an assessment committee for first year composition courses, and we've watched those reports that we've done. We spent painstaking amount of time, hours and hours of time, kind of tallying all this stuff, doing the assessment, making sure that we're relying upon best practices nationwide, and we watch those reports go to our administration, and they go unread. And we know they go unread because when you sit down and have conversations with them based upon what that they said, they don't know like what's on page one of the report, let alone what's on page three or four. And we all know that they're just trying to check boxes because there's been this push on assessment that's been coming from the accreditors, the middle states in our case. Where does that pressure come from? Well, some of that is coming from the Obama administration, because you all remember that the corporate Democrats, just like their right-wing colleagues, love to go and do standardized testing as a way of evaluating schools. This is the same thing. So right now, when we see standardized tests being used to shut down public schools, especially in the inner cities across this country, right, Pennsylvania is getting hit hard by that. This is the opening that door to that no child left behind, standardizing test regime being applied to higher education. You're basically going to have an outcomes test, right, that is going to be the determinant as to whether a faculty member is doing their job or not, regardless of the difficulty of the content, regardless of how, what that student body is like, regardless of a whole range of other factors that go into this. And, you know, say what you want. You want to call me conspiracy on this one, but I look at that, and that's what that is. That is the opening the door to bring that standardized testing regime right here to higher education, the state system of higher education. And we know that the chancellor of the state system, Frank Brogan, right, you know, he was Jeb Bush's right-hand guy down there in Florida doing all sorts of education stuff. And Frank Brogan, you know, he's, you know, all tingly in the panties over this kind of standardized assessment stuff. Call me an alarmist, call me what you will, but, you know, this is something I've been reporting on now for years, and kind of sounding the bells, this is the direction that they're going, and here you go. My bet would be that this is Frank Brogan's little baby. So you have that. They also want to do things like, for example, increase a probationary period from 2 to 3 years, right? In which you have very, very limited grievance rights. That basically extends the period of at-will employment that even if you're hired a tenure track faculty, you can be fired for any reason whatsoever. It's incredible. It's really incredible. Now, the last grouping of things, I've got some other things here too, but I know how in the weeds this stuff is. I mean, this is remarkable. But the last grouping of stuff, it's your classic crass shifts, right? And this is about increasing healthcare contributions for 15 to 18%. You want to talk about increase in prescription copays. They want to mandate like a specialty pharmacy, right, that faculty would have to go to. So, for example, the state system decides you have to go to Walmart to get your prescriptions, then we'd be forced to go to Walmart, right? Even if Walmart is the beast that has like helped wreck our economy, hey, if you want your prescription, you got to go there. They want to remove full health care for retirees. Think about that. So people who have put in their lives working for this place. So when they, you know, one of the things they've relied upon is the health care, right? Especially when they retire. Now they basically want to strip that away. We'll do some supplemental Medicare thing, right? You know, depending on what the state does. So now you've made, you know, you've shifted the tax burden. Even you want to think about it like that, like, you know, onto all Pennsylvanians, right, to kind of basically fund their kind of, you know, Medicare and Social Security. And you've basically taken a person's livelihood away once they retire, right? You put them into that much more precarious situation, especially when they need the health care, you know? So you got that going on there too as well. The other thing, which is just, again, baffling, is that one of the things that had been in past agreements, past contracts, is that looking at healthcare costs, right? So the idea is that they wanted us to jump through all these hoops in order to keep costs down. So you have to fill out these surveys and do this healthy you garbage that you got to do online just to make sure that you don't have to pay through the wazoo for your healthcare. Okay. So you got to do this and everyone in your family's got to do it. It's a real pain. And you know, because you, especially what you know what they're doing is they're accumulating data on you so that basically they can target healthcare in ways that are more profitable for the health insurance companies. That's why they do it. But they say it's about keeping costs down, right? So we said, okay, we'll jump, all right? We will go ahead and we'll do this. However, if those costs do come down, like you say they will do, that you're going to share that cost savings with faculty, that you're basically going to say faculty and coaches will no longer won't have to pay at 18%, but since you have the savings, it'll go down to 17%, right? Fair is fair. You want us to do this? Okay. The exchange we want back is that if the cost savings is there, that it just doesn't get put in administrators' pockets or some sort of slush fund out there in Harrisburg, but actually kind of goes back to the people who are actually doing the work to keep the universities going. So that's this. So, you know, folks, I have trouble with this kind of discussion. And let me tell you why. I know that going into the weeds this much is frustrating, right? And can be like mind-numbing to even listen to, or let alone read. I mean, going through this stuff, and believe me, I got my like, you know, monster drinks at hand as I'm going through this stuff. But where else is this done? I mean, frankly, we do not have a public literacy about contracts. We do not have a public literacy about the ways that our higher education programs, our public higher education, our public K-12 systems are being systematically destroyed, right? And there's a reason for that, right? There's a reason that why our schools don't teach us how to read contracts, right? That the most important kind of literature that we read is not, right, the literature of public documents, right, and citizenship engagement. I mean, imagine that. C.L.R. James wrote this in a book, I believe it was in American Civilization a while back. And he said that, you know, American literature is the literature of business. Business literature is American literature. And what he meant by that is like, if you want, because, you know, literature has had a huge role in kind of nation building historically, like in the 18th century, 19th century, especially with the novel. And there's been lots and lots of research about that stuff. But C.L.R. James was pointing to the fact that the literature, which is really about kind of the foundational kind of national kind of identity that makes this nation tick, is really the literature that's coming out of business areas. But we don't read that stuff. As a matter of fact, most of us, when we're confronted with contract language or we're confronted with kind of in the weeds stuff about policy, our eyes tend to glaze over. And we've been trained to do that. Our schools have failed us in that regard. And it's not because the teachers suck, right? It's not because the schools suck. It's because we have people whose interests are in direct opposition to us learning how to read those things. And if you want another example of someone else who's doing this work, you know, John Oliver's show, Last Week Tonight periodically does these kind of exposés, which is about trying to popularizing this obscure American literature, right? The policy literature that's out there. And this past week's episode, he just did this segment on retirement plans and how these financial advisors, which he basically shows that they mean nothing, are basically using fees as a way of completely gutting our retirement, right? By taking up to 2/3 of the money that we should be having for our retirement, taking it away from us and putting it in their own pockets. But in order to make that case, you have to roll it out. So there's that. So I know that this is, you know, painstaking in some ways. But in some ways, I guess maybe this is the way I work. Maybe the way I work that I have to actually get into the weeds and try to understand it and talk about it and write about it before I can extract that bigger narrative. I just hope that, you know, by walking through some of this, I mean, this is, you know, even I feel like as into the weeds as this is, that I've really scratched the surface of the particulars of what's happening in this agreement. So, yeah. So I think I guess I should come up and take a break. I've been bombarding you with this contract stuff for a long time now. But when I come back from the great break, I'll kind of keep it a little bit shorter. And I want to just kind of bring it together a little bit about what this means about going forward and why faculty are, you know, at the point where they think it might be time to take a strong stand, draw that line in the sand and say, we are not going to stand by as these people destroy public higher education in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Anyways, this is Kevin Mahoney. I am the editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. This is Raging Chicken Radio's Out to Coop podcast, and we'll be back right after this. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Over the past 5 years, we've brought unapologetic progressive activist media to Pennsylvania and beyond. We've helped hold those in power accountable and shine a light on some amazing activist work. We've broken national stories and established a reputation as an aggressive citizen media site. As newsrooms close and traditional journalists lose their jobs, hard-hitting investigative news suffers. If we care about our democracy, we have to find new sustainable models of journalism, and frankly, no one's going to do it for us. So take a minute to become a member of Raging Chicken Press. For as little as $5 a month, the price of a good beer or a cup of coffee, you will be supporting homegrown progressive journalists and media activists. Go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab to become a member. Leave a one-time donation or learn about other ways you can help. We don't have billionaire backers. Keeping progressive, activist media going strong depends on you. Thank you for all your help and support, and keep up the fight. Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio's Out to Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney. I'm the editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Normally, Out to Coop is our weekly podcast where we check in with our Capitol correspondent, Sean Kitchen, on the good, the bad, and the ugly that is Harrisburg, PA. But of course, Sean is on vacation out in the Great Mountain West. So you're stuck with me getting into the weeds on the ABSCUF contract fight. So what's this all mean? Well, I mentioned this a little bit earlier, but ABSCUF President Ken Mash, the negotiations team, Vice President Jamie Martin have basically all said that this may just be the time where faculty are going to have to take a stand. And again, I'll go back to the press statement that ABSCUF released and kind of how Mash put it. He said, quote, "There is enough in their contract proposals, the state system presented today, to insult and harm every faculty member. But we are used to that. Going after the quality of our students' education goes over the line. We will not be participants in undermining the system's legislatively mandated charge to deliver quality education to our students." There it is. I mean, nobody likes the thought about going on a strike. Nobody likes that fact, right? And I know right now that there are faculty members that are they're going to start weighing whether or not this is worth it. I'll tell you, last time around, we got to the point where it was time to go. And then the state system was like, they realized that our resolve was real. And they backed off. But here they are again. They're going to take their next swing at it. So really, the charge is going to be to faculty members across the state system of higher education determine, is this worth spending the time to ensure that we protect public higher education in this state? Are we going to put our money where our mouths are, right? Faculty talk a lot about quality higher education, about being it about the students, being committed to critical thinking, critical analysis, a liberal education, producing well-rounded students, right? Contributing to the, the well-being of our democracy and citizenship. Well, right now, I think all faculty are being called to answer the question as to whether or not they're going to walk the walk, whether or not we mean those words when we say that we believe in the mission of higher education. It's a commonplace saying, right? People will always say about faculty members, and I'm sure they say this in other industries as well, but they say this about faculty members is faculty members, you know, we're kind of trained in doing individual research, right? You spend a lot of time alone. We spend a time with our research and our teaching and our classes. I mean, getting these blinders on our heads, and that we look at things through the lens of, you know, how's this going to affect me? As long as my little world is okay, that I'm not going to do anything about it. But this contract, just like the last contract, is calling us all to kind of think about the we and think about the big picture. Think about if we're willing to step out of our comfort zones, of our little offices, our little course offerings, the things that we enjoy so much about being faculty members and working with students, just as the mission of higher education is in jeopardy right now. And I think, you know, the Verizon workers really laid the groundwork for the way forward. Is that, I was out on the lines with Verizon workers several times during the strike. And what I heard over and over again from those people that are on the lines, you've been out there for weeks, was that, you know, sometimes you got to put aside what's comfortable for yourself and you have to take a stand for what's right, you know. And they told me directly, they don't like being out there. You know, it's hot sun, not getting a paycheck, having to deal with, you know, trying to manage a strike and pay your bills and all that kind of stuff right across the bottom. But they said, sometimes you got to stand up. Enough is enough, right? We have to stand up against this corporate greed, like Verizon, one of the kind of most, the wealthiest corporations in the world, right? In this country, making profits hand over fist, basically trying to squeeze its workers. Well, you know, in some ways, what we see right now in the state system of higher education is no different. I mean, true, there are things that are different, right? There are things that are different. So, for example, we had the former governor, Tom Corbett, was attempting to bleed the state system dry, right? To basically, you know, cut it to the point of destruction. You still have a legislature which is dominated by right-wing Republicans who are seeking to continue Tom Corbett's slash and burn policies towards education in the state, both K-12 and higher ed. And yet, the path forward is not more austerity. The path forward, if we care about the mission of higher education, if we care about educating critical citizens, right, people who are capable of engaging critically in the world, not simply cogs in the corporate machine. If we believe in that mission of higher education, then we got to draw a line here. And now I know I'm kind of blurring lines here. Like in some ways, I'm coming to you here as the editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. But I am speaking to you in the we of as a faculty member, an ABSCA faculty member, someone who cares deeply about higher education. And I think it's time that we say enough is enough. And I think it's, you know, parents and students in this state have just taken it on the chin over and over again. It's time that, you know, we have to stop taking the blows and stand up and say enough. So we're going to be getting to more of this as the weeks go on. I really encourage folks to also to, pay attention to the Rick Smith Show, and it's the ricksmithshow.com. For those of you who are tuning in for the first time, Rick, he runs a labor radio show out of Harrisburg, PA. And, you know, Rick has been the one, you know, consistent voice in this state that has covered the struggles of educators across the state from, you know, from kindergarten through higher ed, about defending higher education and bringing folks on to talk about why it is so important. You know, he's said over and over again that education is the hill that the working class needs to die on. In other words, that this has been the one promise that has kept that American dream alive for so many people. Right. It's been that one grounds of hope, even amidst mass inequality, that there is a possibility to go forward. That's under threat right now, folks. So I'm urging drawing that line and saying we will not let the state system of higher education go down in flames. So This has been a In the Weeds version of Out to Coop podcast from Raging Chicken Radio. And again, I'm Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. For those of you who want to support the growth of activist media, progressive media in this state, we're going to urge you once again to become a member of Raging Chicken Press. You can go to ragingchickenpress.org and click on the support and membership tab and then click on the become a member. You can become a member for as little as $2 a month. Or if you're listening to this on a podcast on Podbean, you go to rcpress.podbean.com and click on the become a patron button and kind of will sign you up. All right. So next week we should have Sean Kitchen back, and he'll be able to tell us tales from the road of Colorado and the craft beer scene. And as I go out, I'm going to make a strong recommendation to anybody who's in the Kutztown area within driving distance, or if you're driving through, to take a stop by Saucony Creek Brewery. It's a kind of local brewery here that does kind of organic ingredients, local sources, a bunch of its stuff, and it's got some all-around great beer. No, if you're asking, no, they do not pay us anything. This is not an advertisement. I'm just thinking right now, after this talk, I could use a beer, so I just made us head over there. So it'd be a great thing. You help and support them. But, you know, hey, if you know some folks over Saucony Creek and you think that they should support this podcast, why don't you tell them? Say, why don't you support Raging Chicken? We'd welcome them aboard. Anyways, it's Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press, has been Out to Coop podcast for June 14th, 2016. I'm going to finally sign off, folks. See ya!